Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. Here we talk about everything to do with human performance and how leaders and organizations can get the best out of themselves and their people. I'm your host, Alex Young. My guest on the podcast today is Jason Lauritsen. Jason is transforming management as a keynote speaker, trainer, and author. He liberates managers from outdated and inhumane practices so that they can cultivate human potential at work and improve people's lives. Jason's advice and teachings are informed by decades of experience as an entrepreneur, corporate executive, and employee engagement researcher. His insights have been described as a secret weapon by leaders who strive to create a more engaging and human experience for their people. We talk about the current state of management training, why cultivating relationships is so important, and the future of work. Hey, Jason, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Alex. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. And we're going to be touching on a couple of things that are very close to my heart, specifically around management and how you, across your journey and experience, have really sort of influenced the lives of lots of managers and people in, both large and small companies, get the best out of their people. But rather than me sort of, stealing all your thunder, it'd be great if you could introduce yourself to everybody listening.
Sure. And I'm never sure quite where to start. So I'll start with the stuff that's most important, which is I am a sort of doting father and husband to a pretty amazing family, which is why I do what I do. I do my work now from what I refer to as the, my home office in the compound here in central U.S. and Nebraska. And for work, I do a few things. Primarily, my goal is to provide management training specifically to kind of middle and early career managers, but across the management spectrum, to help them understand a different way to manage that's really rooted in understanding human behavior and rooted in relationship, and that you can unleash and unlock potential through relationship when you sort of shift how you think about and understand your role as a manager. So I show managers that path and set them free. I'm also a keynote speaker. I do a lot of writing and blogging. And I also host a variety of sort of virtual online events to help introduce other important voices in the world of employee engagement to people. So I do a lot of stuff, but it's all towards the end of trying to make work better for human beings.
Amazing. And I think management is something that has always been, absolutely, vital for me, and has always sort of very much interested me, even when I was in healthcare, when I was, both leading and managing surgical teams. And since leaving, especially with, working with companies that have scaled up quite significantly, that ability to actually manage people, get the best out of people, is so, so vital. And, one of my favorite people in the world is Peter Drucker, who I think described management as being doing things right, and leadership is doing the right things, basically. So I was just wondering, for anybody listening, where do you start when you start looking at how to manage people when you go in and help some of these organizations that you work with?
Well, the important thing, and I think you just hit it, so much of what gets in our way of being effective as managers and leaders, for the purposes of right now, I'm going to use those two terms kind of smashed together. But so much of what gets in the way is how we think about our role and some of the beliefs that we inherited about our roles in management and leadership. And so when I engage with an organization, oftentimes the conversation starts with challenging some of those beliefs, helping them find their way to a different mindset, a different understanding of what our role as managers and leaders are, because that is the foundation. I'm a believer that if I come in and teach you a new behavior, that's great. You might use that new behavior for a while. And as long as that new behavior returns you some kind of immediate impact, then you might keep doing it. But if some condition changes and that behavior doesn't work as effectively anymore, you're not sure how to adapt it, or maybe you just give up on it and you revert back to your old behavior. But if I shift your belief about why you do that, and I give you a new mindset that helps you then find the appropriate behavior, which is, I guess that's the leadership piece, doing the right things. If I help you understand, you know, why you're doing it and why it matters, then as the conditions shift, the particular behavior that I taught you, it's not as relevant. It can shift to another. You'll find your way to the right thing as long as you have that right foundation. And so I find that if you want to drive lasting, sustainable change, it has to start at the mindset and behavior level. Because if it doesn't, then I think oftentimes that's why we get frustrated with management training programs sometimes, is somebody comes in, they teach you a bunch of new skills, and then you get a bump for about a month, and then all of a sudden we're back to doing it the way we were doing it before. And people are scratching their head like, where did all of that go? And it's because we never replaced any of our fundamental beliefs about why we do what we do. And without doing that, oftentimes the change can be kind of fragile.
And I think, you know, just at the individual level for anyone working in any company or any team, becoming a manager and starting to manage groups of people is part of that sort of natural career progression for most people. But it is something that is very, very foreign. And often if you, go up in your career ladder and suddenly you're managing people, it can be a really challenging transition. And you mentioned management training. How adequate do you think, you know, most companies' sort of management training is at the moment?
Well, based on the conversations that I have on an ongoing basis, and just based on what I hear from people, I would suggest that, and I think more broadly, management training, management development, oftentimes these new managers don't even get any training. They're just put into the role. And, you know, if they're lucky, they get some training on the processes they're supposed to use or the policies they're supposed to know about, but they're not given the skills they need to actually manage human performance, to unleash human potential. That is never taught to them. So they're left to their own devices, which means they're going to default to what they've experienced or seen before, which is oftentimes working for other bad managers. And so a cycle of bad management sort of starts and just gets repeated. And even good people fall into that. My early career, I had terrible managers. And then when I became a manager, I wasn't a great manager. And I don't think it was because I was a bad person. It wasn't because I didn't want to manage well. I just had no idea what I was doing. So I was just making a mess of things and repeating mistakes that had been made that managers had made in managing me. And so we have to interrupt that cycle. So I would say, yeah, the current state of management development or management skilling or whatever you want to call it, I think is pretty, pretty dire, I would suggest. I mean, I think we're getting better slowly. And I think actually the pandemic and the experience of distributing work has actually accelerated that a bit, because it revealed how truly terrible we were at managing people. It's hard to hide from it in a distributed environment. And so I think we're creeping the right direction, but there's a lot of work left to be done.
It's a really great point. And I remember, going back to when I was training as a surgeon, for me specifically, when I was learning things like leadership and management, that was done really on the job, quite passively, quite sort of experientially, by looking at some surgeons who were really good leaders or managers and some people who were really poor leaders and managers. And exactly as you say, you will then sort of just naturally adopt some of those practices as you start to take on new roles and responsibilities yourself. But it always kind of struck me in healthcare and equally in business as I transitioned outside, a lot of actual management skills really just center around people and their needs and those soft or power skills of bringing out the best in others. What's your sort of take on that in terms of like the actual skills we need to be teaching managers?
Well, that's a really good point, and I think very true that and this connects back to kind of one of the biggest insights or aha moments I've had in my career. And that was that I spent, you know, so I describe broadly, or often I talk broadly about the work that I do as being employee engagement, because that's a term that's sort of been put out there and it's buzzwordy and it's an HR kind of term often, but it's become broadly, I think, more used more commonly to understand this is about creating an experience of work for the employee that works for the employee and allows them to be their best at work, allows them to do their best work. And so I've been in the business of employee engagement for a long time, studying this for a long time, trying to crack the code on it. And there's a lot of different philosophies and theories. And one of the things that I was privileged to do for a part of my career is I spent 3 years working for an organization called Quantum Workplace. That's an HR technology company that one of the core products they had was an employee survey, an employee engagement survey. And one of the ways they used that was as a research engine for best places to work contests all over the United States. And so I had the opportunity to lead that team for 3 years, the best places to work team. And we were collecting hundreds of thousands of employee survey responses every year. And then we'd kind of take a look at all that data at the end of the year. Our data scientists would look at it and say, okay, what are the things that are most strongly correlated across this whole data set to overall employee satisfaction, performance, retention, the things that we really cared about? And then we would have this like top drivers list, drivers of engagement, drivers of satisfaction, however you want to describe that. And what I noticed was that every year there was always the same kinds of things. There was this sort of list of things that were always in that top list. There were some factors that would come and go based on the year, but there was always these same things like, I want to feel valued, cared for, trusted, appreciated, all of those things. And what hit me when I started seeing this kind of repeatedly coming up and then looking back at our older data sets and seeing it was always in those older data sets and then going and looking at other data sets, like these things are always there, is that These aren't what you would normally think of as work drivers. When we talk about management, or we talk about, you know, in a traditional sense, when you think about those things, care, appreciation, trust, those sound more like relationship. They're relational factors. And so what hit me, this aha moment, was that employees actually experience work like they do any important relationship in their life. And they want the same things out of that relationship that they need out of any important relationship. And so back to your question, the skills that we need as managers desperately are relationship skills. We need to understand how to build connection and build relationship. We need to understand how to help people feel truly appreciated, truly acknowledged, truly accepted. We need to be able to build trust and understand how trust works. All of those things are the foundational skills. And so those are the kinds of skills that I help managers understand. But it starts with the mindset of recognizing that employees aren't there to, you know, fulfill your contract. Right. That's not why they're there. Like, we treat work like a contract, but that's not what they're looking for. What they're looking for is, you know, show me the love, right? Show me that you care. Treat me like I'm in a positive relationship with you. And if you do, I will give you the best that I've got.
You're listening to the Human Performance Podcast by Verti. If you're enjoying this episode, why not join our newsletter? When you sign up, you'll receive a copy of Level Up straight to your inbox every Thursday with the latest tips, tricks, and news about all things human performance. Head over to verti.com/newsletter to sign up. That's verti.com/newsletter. You can find this in the show notes. Anyway, back to the episode.
And in terms of, you know, building those relationships just on a very practical level, it always occurs to me that, you know, just some simple changes that people can make, you know, have huge impacts on their employees. You know, having, you know, just open and respectful lines of communication, as you say, making sure that people feel valued, whether that's running something like an actual kind of like company or corporate award system, or whether it's just, you know, feeding back to people on a day-to-day basis, you know, your own sort of opinion and encouraging them. That's really what kind of high performers want. And again, I sort of look back at my time working in healthcare, which was incredibly busy. I never really wanted sort of like a higher salary or anything like that because I enjoyed helping patients. But the bits where I really got enjoyment was when actually, you know, someone I was working with or a patient or a colleague actually said, you know, you did a really great job there. And simple things like that can make a huge difference to people. How do you think you kind of like instigate that behavior change, which might not be, which sounds obvious when we talk about it, right? But it might not be that obvious for some managers at the moment in some organizations.
Well, I think a lot of times what happens with, I mean, even in what you just described there is we tend to think about appreciation and this, the need for appreciation, and we sort of make it almost feel bigger than it needs to be. We make it feel like, well, this is about, I have to, you know, I'm supposed to be acknowledging you for stellar performance or whatever, which is still a holdover from traditional management practices. Because in traditional management practice, we were taught that you should only recognize people for above and beyond performance. And as a result, what happens is we've created a system of management where we generally ignore the middle 80% of our employees who show up every day and do their level best to meet expectations, which is that it's their expectations and they're meeting them. And yet at the end of each day, often they feel like they're not sure if anybody even noticed they were there. And so it doesn't have to be complicated. And this is the thing that I break down for managers and leaders is that at its essence, and this actually goes back to, I can't even claim credit for this. This research has been out there 20 years. The Gallup folks put out their book, How Full Is Your Bucket, which, you know, is a gimmicky way of kind of helping people think about this. But it was saying, listen, most people are not getting any sort of recognition moments on an annual basis, and they don't need a lot. What they're looking for is little moments of acknowledgement. They're looking for little moments of appreciation. And so that can be as simple as saying thank you. I'm shocked by how often you know, if you watch a great manager, and I'm sure this is true in healthcare, I'm reflecting on, like, as a patient going into healthcare, you can tell a lot about the doctors that you're interacting with based on how they interact with the support staff around them, the technicians, the nurses. Do they say thank you? Do they acknowledge them when they come in? Do they treat them like, hey, there's another skilled human being in the room? Or do they act as if these people exist to only serve their needs, right? That's what I'm talking about. It's the very simple thing of making eye contact, smiling, saying hi to someone when you see them in the hallway, saying thank you, saying, acknowledging them even for simple things. And this is not to say that you shouldn't be acknowledging your high performers for exceptional performance. Of course you should do that. No organization really has a problem with that. High performers are easy to find. They're easy to recognize. If you're messing that up, then I don't know that I can help you. That's a pretty simple thing to fix. What you need to be worried about is the 80% in the middle who are carrying the organization on their back and don't feel like anybody notices what they do. And so there's, I mean, to your point about how do you teach people to do this, I think there's simple things you can do. When I was researching for my most recent book, Unlocking High Performance, one of I did a bunch of interviews with organizations or leaders within organizations that had exceptional cultures. One of the most common things that I heard, common practices I heard, was that in any meetings that they had, so team meetings or stand-ups, huddles, whatever it was the most common way they described it is they would have time set aside to do shout-outs, to go around the horn, around the meeting, and have everybody sort of, you know, vocalize appreciation or acknowledgement to anyone else, either in the meeting or outside the meeting, who they felt either they had seen do something exceptional or noteworthy, or who had been helpful to them. So it was sort of appreciation and it was gratitude. And so that was one of the ways that, you know, if you think about it, it's one of the most simple ways that you can model it, practice it, teach it, reinforce it. And if you start to do that and they start to see that, then you know what happens is that you've got a meeting coming up, you know, there's going to be shout out. So guess what? I'm scanning my work environment and my colleagues to notice things that I can shout out in the next meeting. That's where magic starts to happen.
Yeah. And I think, especially, I mean, you mentioned the pandemic earlier, you know, especially now that everyone has gone, you know, remote, to a degree and tools like Slack facilitate this. You know, I think a lot of great companies have been able to make that transition and you know, things like shout outs, which can be done, you know, at the beginning, at the end of a week or you know, during a meeting or a huddle, as you say, have become like even more accessible for people. From your sort of, you know, personal perspective, in terms of how that, you know, culture building has been done pre-pandemic and then now, what are some of, you know, the smartest adaptations you've seen with some of the companies you've been working with?
Well, I think it boils down to most simply, and this hasn't actually changed, I think the practice has pretty much been the same, is being really intentional and specific in articulating what your culture is. I think it drives me insane to hear people talking about how it's so much harder to do culture building, you know, when we're remote or when we're distributed. You know, it's harder to maintain and manage our culture. And I'm like, okay, how were you doing it before? Like, show me the description of your culture. Like, where is the documentation of what your intentional culture was and how were you managing it before you were distributed? And most of the time, it's just sort of a blank stare when that comes back. Maybe they have some value somewhere written down. They have to pull that out and show me. But it's not we weren't doing a good job of managing culture. It just felt like we were because we had all of these sort of false positives, walking into the office or seeing each other. We was like, oh, well, we're managing culture. Now we're distributed. And the funny thing is, the simplest way, there's a lot of definitions of culture, but the one that I always remembered, and I wish I could credit who actually said this, but the simplest definition that always struck with me is that culture is what you do when no one's looking. And I was like, well, in a distributed environment, culture is even more important than it's ever been because there's nobody looking most of the time. And so how am I supposed to know? And I suppose that's why it felt like we were doing a better job of managing culture when we were all together. Whereas now that we're distributed, or if we're working from home, or if we're hybrid or whatever it is, and we're out on our own more, it becomes that much more critical that I'm clear on what is the expected behavior? What is the way that we're going to treat each other? How am I supposed to think about this? What are our values and how does that look in day to day? And so the organizations that are, I think, excelling are organizations that either, number one, had a really clear understanding and definition of their culture before distribution hit, or number two, have recognized that if we want to have a consistent culture, we've got to define it. We have to be able to, you know, we can't measure, we can't manage something that we haven't first defined. And so I think that's where a lot of the work needs to be done. And a lot of organizations have historically just been really sloppy about that. They've taken for granted that, you know, it felt like they were managing their culture, but their culture was really just kind of happening. And it doesn't become a crisis until it starts interfering with what you want to happen. And then usually that's when people get serious, is when there's a crisis. Well, guess what? Global pandemic is a crisis.
And you know, we've touched on it already, in terms of ensuring people feel that they're valued and understanding, you know, their role and how they contribute to an organization. But on the, you know, the topic of, you know, being distributed and being remote with your employees, especially during the pandemic, which is a really tough time for many people. What's your take on how organizations can really kind of cultivate well-being for their employees to get the best out of them? What are some of the tactics and things that you've seen work well from the folks you've been working with?
Well, you just used one of my favorite words, and it's a word that's actually sort of core to the mindset that I teach. So at the beginning of, it's actually one of the core processes I teach in my book about performance management is cultivation. And then in management training, I teach a cultivation mindset, which is at its foundation is that traditional management was really born out of a mindset, a production mindset of we took how we managed machines and we just applied it to people. And so the people became the machinery. And so we treat people like the machinery to be managed and maximized and whatever. A cultivation mindset is born out of a model of, I'll call it gardening or agriculture. So the way that gardeners or farmers think about their role is, you know, there's a trust, there's a core level of trust that when they put a seed in the ground, as long as that seed is in the right kind of soil, it's in the right kind of environment, and it has the things it needs to grow, and the farmer or the gardener keeps obstacles or barriers kind of out of the way, so they, you know, take care of the insects or the animals that might eat it, they keep the weeds cleared out, all of that seed will just naturally, by default, grow into the best version of itself. It's hardwired for performance. And so that's what the cultivation mindset for management is all about, is that we shift to thinking and understanding that human beings are hardwired. Like, it's in our brain, like from when we are born to perform. We are born for growth. When we're not, it's because we have an unmet need or we're facing some kind of obstacle or barrier that's in our way. And so when we think about well-being, well-being is really at the heart. It's one of the most important elements that we have to cultivate as managers, because if my well-being is diminished, then my capacity to perform is diminished. If I am suffering from mental or physical health issues, then I just don't have as much to offer. If I'm worried about feeding my kids, if I'm worried about taking care of my ailing parent, all of those things, if I'm not able to manage that well and that's impacting well-being, then I can't perform. I'm not capable of giving you my maximum potential to perform. And so we have to care for well-being. And there's a lot of things you can do. There's a lot of programs. There's a lot of thing, you know, a lot of stuff out there. What I have been teaching is that I think the most powerful and effective tool of management we have to support well-being, particular, and this is true in any environment, but particularly in a distributed environment, is compassion. And that might not be what you expected me to say, but compassion, what I've discovered as I've been unpacking this and digging in on what do we really need to be doing, is asking the question of, you know, with compassion, it's compassion. When you break it apart, actually, the psychologists have broken it apart and found that compassion is sort of a four-step. There's sort of four pieces to it, which is you have to notice that someone else is struggling or suffering, you know, that they have some kind of issue. You have to care that that is happening. You have to have an intention that you wish that that wasn't happening to them. And then you have to be moved to readiness to take action. And so compassion is all about responding to human suffering. And when our well-being is diminished, then we are suffering. And so as a manager, you can practice compassion. And so much of that starts with just noticing more. And so in practical terms, what that means is you have to spend time. You have to be spending one-on-one time with people. There is no way around that. So you have to make time for one-on-one meetings. You have to make time for check-ins. You need to be using video for those. If you're distributed, you need to be eyeball to eyeball so you can see people's faces and you can have real conversations. And you need to be asking a different kind of question. You need to be asking them human check-in questions, not just always talking about work, but, you know, one of my favorites and the most simple tool is, how are you? Scale 1 to 10. 10 being I'm ideal, strong as I can be. 1 being I'm on the verge of crisis. Where are you at on a 1 to 10 scale? They don't have to say anything other than a number, but that number tells you a whole bunch, because then it opens up the next question. If they're a 2, then the kind of question you're going to ask is different than if they're a 9. But either way, that gets you into the conversation. If they're a 2 or a 5, then there's something going on. You have to notice. Then you ask questions and express care and figure out. The next question is, how can I help? What can I do? And you find a way to do something to help. that's really, if you learn to do that, if you can put compassion into your approach as a manager, then well-being will start to improve. It's a pretty simple equation or process.
And in terms of, you know, I'm sort of going back to, you know, at a sort of, you know, C-suite level, if you're looking to like increase your managers or your organization's, you know, EQ or empathy, you know, across your organization, that, you know, that can be quite a sort of a tricky thing to do. Do you think that that sort of falls on training programs and processes that need to be kind of instigated at that sort of, you know, C-suite top level that then sort of needs to waterfall down? Or what's the best way to sort of start implementing some of that behavior change for people who want to, you know, create managers who are more compassionate in their organization?
I think if you want to see immediate impact, short-term impact, I think it does start at the top. I don't know if it's training or not as much as it is. I think executives have to model this. And so if executives aren't modeling compassion, if they aren't modeling care, if they aren't modeling even self-care, you know, that they're caring for their own well-being and sort of doing this out loud so that their employees and the other leaders that they lead are seeing it and experiencing it, it's going to be really hard to convince a manager that you're actually serious about this. And so the executives have to model it. They have to role model it. Now, some executives might know what that looks like and what that means. You just have to, you know, give them the invitation to do it, to step up, right? Be the change. Some may not know. I mean, in different organizations, you're starting with where you're starting from. And so if the managers or the executive leaders don't understand how to model compassion or care or well-being, then you've got to show them. You have to teach them or help coach them through that. I think coaching is probably more effective at that level than training traditionally, but whatever it takes, whatever mechanism. I think the other key element is, and this also comes from the executive level, is that we have to, from the executive level on down, we have to give our managers permission to care. We have to give them permission to be more invested with their people, because traditional management practice, traditional HR practice was all designed around managing risk down. So we were trying to decrease risk. So we told people, don't get too personally invested with your people. Don't get involved in their personal lives, because that creates risk for us. But today, if you are not invested in their personal lives, if you do not know what's going on with them, especially if they're working from home, guess what? Their personal life is their workplace. So you had better know what's going on. You had better be supporting them, because if you're not, that drives up your risk. And so it has completely shifted. And I think managers very simply need to be told, like, hey, different game, different circumstance, it's okay, right? You don't forget what we told you before about keeping work and life all separate, because that doesn't make any sense anymore. You need to be more invested with your people, and you need to build a different kind of relationship with your people. They need that permission in order to do it, because a lot of them won't do it because they're afraid. We've scared the bejesus out of most of them.
I think that's a really great point. And obviously, you know, you have made some kind of, you know, own adaptations, as well as sort of writing a book. You're also doing online and live kind of coaching with organizations that you work with. You know, from your sort of experience of doing that during the pandemic, as well as sort of, you know, writing your book, I know that towards the end of your book, one of the things you talk about in depth is sort of how you then implement, you know, your new sort of performance management techniques. And a couple of things you touch on is how technology, coaching, training can really sort of help that. For anybody listening, what are some of your kind of preferred, you know, pieces of technology or ways to sort of engage with your people to help keep those habits, you know, after you've perhaps finished your online training or coaching with people with whom you work?
That's a really great question. I'm going to talk about it in the context of organization, just because I think that's probably more applicable for most people that are listening, is how do you use technology at scale, right, to support some of this? And you hinted earlier, I mean, the technologies that I think are really valuable are those that help you put the discipline and put sort of habit building activities behind these human, you know, these human behaviors we want to reinforce. So I'm a fan of a lot of the tools that do appreciation, sort of social appreciation or social recognition at scale. So things that allow me to, you know, go on and recognize Alex for doing a great podcast interview in a way that'll and sort of connect that back to a specific behavior so that other people can see me doing that, learn from it, and then be inspired to do that. Social recognition systems create kind of a virtuous, positive, contagious cycle if they're implemented right and used right. So I think I'm a fan of that. I think technology, the fact that we have video technology platforms the way we do, I mean, Zoom is probably one of the most powerful tools that we have. I know there's others, Microsoft Teams and others, but you know, I get people don't like to hear me say this because of the, you know, this popular Zoom fatigue kind of narrative that's going on. But the managers that I teach and the people I work with, like I always have video on for every meeting, partly because I know and understand the power of eyeball to eyeball, person to person interaction. And yes, being together with a person in person is the most powerful way to foster relationship. But video is a close second when it's used appropriately with intention. And so I think that is a really powerful tool when used correctly. But I say all of this with a grain of salt in that, and you'll, you know, the thing that I talk about at the end of the book is really that this is about experience design and that it should be anything you do with your performance or your management system. When you're thinking about it, it's really about designing an employee experience that cultivates human performance for the particular employees that you have. And so you have to get clear first on the kind of experience and the things they need. What does that look like? And then finding technology tools that allow you to create that, that enable that. Because a lot of times, and you know, I've been working in the HR tech space for a long time. It's really, you know, that expression, the tail wagging the dog, is really true often with technology tools. We put a tech tool in, and then we try to retrofit how we do what we do from a management perspective or from an organizational perspective to the tool. And then it doesn't work because it's not a fit for us. And then we blame the tool. And then we go on to another tool that doesn't really fit, as opposed to getting clear on what do we need to do for our business context and our people. And then let's find a tool that enables that. So take everything with a grain of salt that I'm saying here. Find the tool that helps you create the experience that your employees need to perform at their best. That's really the best advice I can give.
No, that's awesome. And I completely agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, any technology should make the lives of the user much easier rather than, you know, harder. And, you know, again, I'm thinking back to my time in healthcare where I think I had about 20 passwords for different things at one point, and it just slowed everything down, which yeah. is, you know, the bad side of, you know, introducing tech into the workplace. Sticking with kind of, you know, tech and your experiences of how, you know, people management and organizational structures kind of changed, you know, in recent times. Where do you think the future of work is heading? We've obviously got a young, very technologically able workforce coming through now who've kind of grown up with, you know, Netflix, Fitbits, TikTok, you know, and all these kind of online resources. What do you think are some of the things that, you know, organizations should be looking at now to, you know, firstly kind of attract and retain early stage employees, but also to, in, you know, embed in their managers as these, you know, new folks are coming through?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And it's funny, before the pandemic, when things were, you know, the answer to what is the future of work was a lot, I think, simpler, because a lot of it is what's happening right now. And so when we look forward, I think that, you know, the trends are suggesting that whatever, no matter what happens, you know, work is going to be, I know we're really fixated right now on where are we going to work, you know, as a primary question, things about location and place and time. But I think what has again been, if I back up and think about it, through the lens of production versus cultivation, which is sort of where everything for me goes back to. A lot of the questions that we're wrestling with today are still production related questions, right? You've got executive leaders thinking about where do we want our machinery located? Do we want the machinery in an office building? Do we want our machinery sometimes in an office building, sometimes at their house? They're trying to control which days it's going to be. All of that is still production. That's still thinking of those human beings as mechanisms of production, as opposed to, I think the future of work is going to be finally where we're going to shift to realize that we, you know, these two fundamental ideas. Number one is employees experience work as a relationship. And so how can we design this work, whatever work it is you're doing, to feel more like a healthy relationship, and that it's a two-way, reciprocal, mutually committed relationship that has accountability and has mutual appreciation and trust and all of that. What does that look like? And how does that actually look when we do that at scale? And I think that completely changes the skill sets of managers. It completely changes what we're teaching and training, not only managers, but employees. So I think that will evolve more. We're going to see, and I think you're seeing that already. You're seeing more investment in trust building and appreciation and the kinds of things that we've been talking about. That I think that trend is happening. I think the thing that hasn't caught up yet is the future of work will be designed around the employee experience. And the sad part is that we know how to do this. We, you know, the product designers, I mean, Alex, to your point about technology, right? Nobody, like, you think about Amazon, right, is the ubiquitous example, but Amazon, nobody has to teach you how to use Amazon. Amazon, like, by using it, it knows you, it delivers to you things that you like, hey, you might like this. It's like, well, wow, how do you know that? Yes, I do like that, or I would like that. It makes your life easier. It delivers you. And we know how to do that. It just hasn't been applied to work yet. And that is the expectation on employees, is like, I need work to work for me. I need it to be able to work in the context of all of this craziness that I have. And so I think if I were going to say that the two shifts are going to be really making work more relational, and then the second is going to be designing a complete redesign of how we think about work. And instead of asking questions like, what days should we be in the office, or how many days should we be in the office, we'll be asking questions like, what kind of experience do we need to create to maximize that employee's ability to perform at peak potential? Right? That is the question we should be asking. And we're just not there yet. Some organizations are getting closer to it, but we're not there yet.
No, some great points. And just as we, start to wrap things up, I mean, you've, created some amazing resources for anyone who's looking to kind of upskill themselves on management, or even just kind of interpersonal skills and how to sort of run performance reviews and things like that through your books and your online courses and website. I'd be really interested to learn from you, who sort of inspired you on your journey, and who your kind of human performance hero is.
Boy, that's a really interesting question. I'm going to give you two answers to that question. The one is the easiest answer that came to mind for me is Coach Krzyzewski. I'm a lifelong Duke basketball fan. And Coach K is legendary for being able to take a basketball team and develop leaders and maximize performance there. And I've just always respected the way that he's done it, how he's done it, the dignity and professionalism that he demonstrates. So that's always been an inspiration to me. I would also say at a really broad level, my other kind of hero in my work is Gary Hamel. And, you know, Gary Hamel has written some really incredible, he's done some incredible work, written some incredible things. I had the privilege to interview him a year or so ago on my webcast, and just hit when Gary, I remember hearing him say when I was watching a presentation of him at one point, and he was the one that really unlocked it for me when he said, you know, he talked about management as an innovation, as an invention. It's probably the most important invention of the 20th century. But that fundamentally, management's initial goal was to get human beings to perform like semi-programmable robots. And like that idea, like the way that he unpacked that and phrased it, and the way that he describes and explains stuff has always been an inspiration to me. So those are probably the two that I have taken the most inspiration and that I role model myself after if I can.
Amazing. Well, great examples. And Jason, if people do want to, you know, reach out or find out more or grab your book, where's the best place for them to go?
Easiest place to find me is my website is jasonlauritsen.com. That's if you can spell my last name, you'll find me in lots of ways. If you plug it into the Googles, I try to be as easy to find as possible, but it's L-A-U-R-I-T-S-E-N. If you can spell my last name, you'll be able to find me.
Amazing. Well, Jason, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And, you know, I hope you, you know, continue on your successful journey and your mission of sort of, you know, making work, you know, the best place for people to spend their time. And you know, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been great speaking with you.
Likewise, Alex, I appreciate it.